Okay, I believe the mayor is not here today, so I'm in charge. And the first thing I'll do is delegate my authority to Susan Anderson to take over the work session. I'm not sure.
So good morning, Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with me our Chief Planner, Joe Zender, and Sandra Wood and Morgan Tracy on AV, it appears. Today we're going to talk about the residential infill project. Mayor Hales initiated this and several other projects last year along with the work that you all were doing as part of the comprehensive plan, because you were hearing a lot of different concerns around the community. An increasing number of demolitions, infill that was larger than the houses that were next door, and that was becoming a concern to many people, and it's still a concern. Also, many people being priced out of their neighborhoods, either as renters or wanting to move into neighborhoods that they could no longer afford. So the residential infill project is really part of a larger response to that problem. You've already done several things. You've instituted a demolition delay for historic properties. You've required additional notice to neighbors for all residential demolitions. You adopted a requirement for deconstruction for older homes older than 100 years old, and that goes into effect today. You also pushed forward several different affordable housing proposals and significant funding. And we will soon bring to you, and you will be considering, an inclusionary housing proposal. So a lot's been moving in the past year, and this is a part of that package. We started this specific project in July of 2015, so a little over a year ago. We recruited a very diverse range of people to a stakeholder committee, an advisory committee. They represented various neighborhoods, residential builders, remodelers, architects, realtors, advocates for affordable housing, advocates for accessibility, aging in place, historic preservation, and other issues. The committee spent about a year going very deep into the issues, including the scale of houses, looking at housing choice and type and size of homes, and narrow lot development. Sandra and Morgan and other staff worked very closely with the committee to bring this all together and pull together a report that you have now. Earlier, they brought together initial concepts, took them out to dozens of open houses, forums, and meetings throughout this past summer, and they worked with the committee to put together the report and the concept. So I want to remind you that this is a little different process than what we usually do. What we're asking you to do is adopt a resolution and not specific code language at this time. So the plan is to have the discussion today, lay out the concepts for you. You're going to have two hearings on the concepts, one on November 9th and one on November 16th, and then vote on the resolution in December. And then once you've given us this direction, we will go back and develop the code and do the traditional sort of legislative process where we do outreach to the community on a draft zoning code proposal, have it go through the Planning and Sustainability Commission, and then they will provide their recommended code language to you. And that will happen by early summer, correct? Okay, early summer. So you give us direction. Here's the key components you want to have in the zoning code of changes, and then we'll go put together that code and bring it back to you. If there's not any questions about the process, I will turn it over to the three of them.
Yep.
Thanks.
Good morning, commissioners. So I'm going to do a quick sort of introduction. So you want to get going there? Okay, so this is what we're doing today for the briefing. I'm going to give you a really quick background. Susan covered the introduction. Morgan and Sandra are going to cover the three real parts of the proposal. And then we're going to finish up with Tyler Bump joining us to talk through economic analysis we did of the potential impact on development. So, and between each of those pieces of the recommendations, we're going to stop and take Q&A and have a discussion with you all. So just a reminder, we adopted a comprehensive plan And the heart of it is that Portland, through its growth and development, is going to be prosperous, healthy, equitable, and resilient. And a big part of that equity piece is access to opportunity for all. Over the next 20 years now, but by 2035, we're growing by 123,000 households. And that growth is a large part of how we're going, is what's going to shape the upcoming development of the city. And an interest, something to remember about that growth, we always focus on just accommodating the 123,000. But in part, we're shaping the city well beyond those 25 years. And that's, you can see that we're, the plan we built, and actually the next slide shows the way we're going to deal with that growth. The plan we built is building on the foundation of what we have in the city in the past. This next 25 years not merely sets us up to accommodate that growth, but sets us up for 50, sets us up for 75. In doing this process, 20% of the growth that we expected to get is coming in the neighborhood sections. And today, we're talking about residential infill and single-family areas. Most of that is captured in that 20%. When we did the 20% in the comprehensive plan, we were really counting on a lot of that development coming from the R25, so the townhouse zones that are scattered about that we're talking about in the zoning proposal now, and then on skinny lots, a little bit of infill single family, but you know, a lot of our single family areas are built out. Part of what this project is to broaden the array of types of housing that we can use to get to that 20%. We're doing this in the context of a housing affordability crisis. As you know, supply and demand have been out of sync for long enough that it's driven down our vacancy rate and up the prices of housing. We're doing this in the context of a city that's predominantly, up to now, single-family houses. With this next round of growth, that's going to get closer to 50-50. But if you look at that graph, the ADUs, the duplexes, and the attached houses is a really small portion of what we have in our stock today. A bigger portion of what's in the DNA of the city, if you look at how we developed in some of our older and the streetcar neighborhoods, and part of what we're talking about today is bringing that back. We're doing
just
this in
interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
Thanks. I haven't been checking my email as much as I could have. Well, I haven't had time to check my email. But I had a question in the last work session we had about the numbers as to how much more capacity does the new comprehensive plan map give us, even without this?
The new comprehensive plan map is designed to accommodate the 123,000 households. But even within that, Commissioner, there's more capacity to grow in the future in residential development especially. It comes from our mixed-use corridors primarily. So
we don't actually have to do this to meet our growth targets?
Not to meet the growth targets per se for the next 20 years, but you do in the sense of meeting the growth projects is not just a numbers game. It's a game that also is about housing opportunity, fair housing, and actually sort of growing and being able to grow beyond even the 20 years and maintaining the character of our neighborhoods.
Right, so there's those kinds of policy choices, but in terms of the numbers that we have to show Metro, we don't have to do this. Because I'm remembering the Southwest Community Plan where she passed a charter change or something at Metro saying that the residential neighborhoods didn't have to do these changes.
So I think Morgan and Sandra will walk through. There's several components of this. It's not just about the middle housing. That's one of the components of the three components we're going to talk about. If we do not increase the amount of what we're calling middle housing, it just means that more has to go into the centers in terms of regular apartments along the corridors. So that's the trade-off.
Does this pie chart show current allocation?
Yes.
Okay, that's current.
Yeah, that's what exists on the ground today. We did housing affordability. So the next piece of context is just that 40-some, almost half of the land in the city is in single-family zones. So we're accomplishing this growth in the next 20 years in that context as well. And the other piece of this to keep in mind is In our comprehensive plan, it's not just hitting growth numbers and centers and corridors. We also have policies in there about housing opportunity. And this is a graph, or this is a map that's in the comprehensive plan, but we drew it from the city's housing policy about housing opportunity areas. You may remember that. And this is a policy where in the Housing Bureau, where do you target your affordable housing development with those limited amounts of funds? And this policy came to the conclusion that even though it may be more expensive, it's really valuable to households to be in areas that already have a lot of opportunities, already have a lot of the things that contribute to the success of a household. So the map you're going to see in the discussion we do later combines all those elements. The goal of the project that we undertook is set as shown there, defined by the committee that was helping us, sort of advising us on the overall project. And in that wheel is sort of the spectrum of objectives that committee pulled together. What we tried to do in these proposals is find some balance amongst those. Some are more met than others. And then finally, here is the just sort of a summary of the public engagement that we did go through that Susan described. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Morgan to start the presentation of the proposals. Okay.
And so before we do that, I just wanted to pass out this four-page summary. We're going to be working through this. So as Susan noted, this project really addresses three topic areas. Scale of houses, increasing the range of housing choice, and development on narrow lots. So we'll start off with talking about scale of houses. So currently, scale is defined by a combination of the maximum building coverage on a lot times its maximum building height. And this is the maximum volume allowed under current code. This image is showing a range of house sizes on 5,000 square foot lots. And on the left, you can see a 1,500 square foot house, which is fairly representative of typical older Portland homes. On the far right is what is allowed under current code, which, to much of our surprise when we calculated it, was about 6,750 square feet. In 2013, we weren't building 6,700 square foot houses. The maximum size house was about 4,400, but the trend for larger homes is moving towards larger and larger homes. Our recommendation is, the first recommendation would limit the size of houses in an R5 zone on 5,000 square foot lots to 2,500 square feet. The limit on house size would vary by two key factors, the size of the lot and the zone that it's located in. And so what this graph is showing is as the lot size increases along the bottom axis from left to right, the house size gets larger, which is shown along the left axis. So this is an example of an R5 lot. On a 5,000 square foot lot, the house would be 2,500 square foot max. Higher intensity zones like the R2.5 with generally higher levels of development, smaller lot sizes would have a higher FAR, a higher proportion of development capacity. And less intense zones with generally larger lot sizes like R7 would have a lower floor to area ratio.
Tell us what that would be.
So at least in concept, we're talking about a 0.5 FAR, 0.5 to 1.
No, I mean, how many square feet would you be allowed to do in R7?
Gotcha. So if we took that same 5,000 square foot lot, it would be about 2,000 square feet. If it was a 7,000 square foot lot, it would be about 2,800 square feet, so 0.4 to 1 FAR.
And that doesn't include the basement. It does not.
Yeah, a couple caveats. It wouldn't include basements or low ceiling attic space. So one of the benefits of FAR is it offers flexibility.
Could you explain what FAR is for people watching at home?
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, I jumped into the FAR lingo there. So it's a floor area to site area ratio. So it calculates the amount of lot area you have, takes a proportion of that, some ratio of that floor area, of that site area, and that's the maximum square footage of house could be, which is different than building coverage, which is just measuring that two-dimensional plane on a lot. So one of the benefits to FAR is that it offers flexibility. So this example shows three varieties of houses, all the same size, all on the same lot size, in three different configurations, either spread out across one story, a wider two-story house with a larger backyard, or a narrower true story. So in addition to the cap on house sizes, detached accessory structures would have an extra floor area allowance. So this is intended to encourage creation of detached ADUs or garages, while also breaking up the overall massing of structures on a lot. Recommendation number two proposes to lower the house roof line. So the current code sets the height limit at 30 feet and measures from a base point at the highest grade next to a house, which is the house on the left, the yellow house. These two requirements can sometimes have the result of homes that are three or even four stories tall. So the recommendation would be to limit homes to 2.5 stories and better relate the height measurements to the street.
So could you just go over that again too, please? Because obviously we've been trying to figure out how to do height restrictions on sloped lots in particular and where you measure it from.
Yeah.
Could you explain that again, please?
So the concept is to measure from the low side of the adjacent to the structure rather than the high side of the structure. So if you look at those two comparison graphics, we would be measuring from the downhill side when you're measuring on an upsloping lot that slopes up from the street. And the conversely, if it slopes down from the street, we would be using something similar to the average street grade to establish that base point measurement.
But is that the lot line, not in the street?
That would be at the lot line.
Thanks.
Maintaining a pattern of established front setbacks is important in neighborhood streetscapes. Some single-dwelling neighborhoods have larger front setbacks than what current code allows, or requires, rather. Recommendation number three would increase the front setback, but also acknowledges that in some areas, the established setback along the street is smaller. So the proposal would permit homes to reduce the setback to match the adjacent house where this condition exists. So essentially, we're increasing front yards, but allowing for homes to match their neighbors to better line up along the street. So before moving on to the next topic, I'll take additional clarifying questions about the scale proposals.
So what happens if it's along a short street frontage and there isn't a house next door? For setbacks, yeah.
There's not a house on either side?
Right.
Then it would be pushed back to 15 feet.
Thank you. Yep. Why did you choose 15, not 18? Because I thought we had that front setback.
There's a garage entrance setback of 18 feet.
And that stays.
And that's proposed to stay. So some of this detail that you're asking about, we will continue to refine as we get through the code drafting process. But a little bit of that differentiation was to continue to encourage that garage to be a little further back than the front of the house.
Well, I'm also thinking about maybe having parking in a driveway, even if
right.
You don't have a garage.
Yeah, that's another thing that has to be worked out in terms of where that parking space could go.
Thank you.
I have a question. In my old neighborhood, I used to live in Grant Park before we sold our house and I moved into an apartment. And next door to where we lived was our neighbor that had about a 1,500 square foot bungalow, a classic Grant Park bungalow that she bought in the 70s for about $30,000. She sold it for about $400,000. And the developer demolished it and put a very big house, which I'm guessing is closer to 4,000 square feet. A very big house. And that house sold for $800,000. So that shows you, you know, how the market's operating. I guess the question I would have is, on the 2,500 square foot house that we're focusing on, do you have data on what the median sale price is citywide for a house that size?
So I'm going to hold off on the economic questions. Tyler Bump will get a little more into that detail.
Yeah.
But the issue you're raising, I want to reflect a little bit about something I heard from one of our stakeholders when we were doing outreach about this increasing trend for larger and larger homes. And this, it was a builder saying, the city is making me build larger homes, which I think is a little bit of a diversion from the situation. But in essence, there's this issue about level playing field. So as a builder acquires property, a lot of that cost is in the land value, and recouping that cost of the land is in building a house that can sell for more. So that is driving, in part, the homes to get larger and larger. And so builders, if they're competing against other builders, are trying to keep up with that pressure to increase the house sizes. So that's somewhat leading to that scale issue.
Great. Good morning, commissioners. So we're moving on to the second topic, which is the topic of housing choice. While the last topic, Morgan was talking about reducing the size of houses, this one is about allowing additional flexibility about what happens inside those units in select areas. So we're moving on to the second, the green sheet here about housing choice. There are four recommendations in this proposal. The first two really work together, recommendation four and recommendation five, so they're kind of it. Really work together. The recommendation four is about the what of like what types of additional housing types. Recommendation five is about the where we're proposing those additional housing types. So working on recommendation four, as you know, in single family residential zones, that generally means one house per lot, and that's the rule, but the zoning code already contains multiple exceptions to that. The one that you're most familiar with and most prevalent is the availability of ADUs on all single-family lots, both attached and detached ADUs. We also have other exceptions for duplexes on corner lots, and sometimes those duplexes can also be attached houses on corners. And so those are shown in these examples here. There are other code exceptions of houses or lots that are next to a commercial zone are also allowed in an additional unit type. So those are already what's existing and on the books, and we have them throughout Portland neighborhoods. What we're proposing under this recommendation is that the code allowances generally be increased by one unit within some areas of the city, and I'll get to what those areas of the city are in a bit. So for single houses, currently we allow one ADU per lot. We would now be allowing two ADUs per lot, one internal and one external. Duplexes, now only allowed on corner lots, would be allowed on any lot, and each duplex would also be allowed to have one ADU. On corner lots, where duplexes are currently allowed by the code, triplexes would be able to be built. So that's the...
Let me jump in on ADUs for a second, just pose a question. We this council has taken steps to create incentives for accessory dwelling units, and I think at one point under maybe Dan's leadership, we waived at SDCs and done other things. Pardon me?
We still have them waived.
And yet, they're not built out to capacity, even close to capacity, in the existing zoning. Mm-hmm. So I think it begs a question that we need to think about is, do we need an additional incentive here to allow two when they're not being built out to existing code?
Well, so this change, the rate of ADU production has gone up, of course, and a little, and part of that's related to the SDC waivers, which you know are something we're doing now, but may change in the future. But the pace of change is really what could vary by the fact that we're allowing more units and more types of units in single-family neighborhoods. And the accessibility of those to different types of households, because whatever is replaced by a new structure is going to have either going to be a 2,500 square foot house, or it's going to be two smaller units that for all intents and purposes looks like a single family house. So there's more choices, smaller choices spread throughout the neighborhoods.
Joe, let me just ask you a philosophical question. Once upon a time, I think we looked at accessory dwelling units as the place that a family downsizing could move into and rent out their home to keep their property, or a place where you could house a mother-in-law or a child that is emancipated and can't afford to rent a place. So we thought about it as creating a set of conveniences for the family. Now, as I understand it, the focus is increasingly on rental possibilities from ADUs. And accessory dwelling units are becoming very popular with short-term rental companies and other folks. So at what point, as we make these changes, particularly with ADUs, are we in effect fundamentally changing the residential character of a neighborhood? Where's that line? And I don't ask that to challenge this premise. I'm asking you to help us sort of figure out where that line is, because I think we're getting close to a tipping point.
And if I could just piggyback on that, I know you're going to be going through some of the things, but the first thing that comes into my mind when I'm looking at this is going to increase the number of demolitions, not help it.
So on the demolition question, the economic analysis will help give us insights into that. That's not the finding of that analysis, but we'll get to it in the end. The tipping point of a neighborhood. Well, part of what we're trying to do is return to a type of development in our neighborhoods that's really in the DNA of the city when you look at especially our inner streetcar or neighborhoods. This is something that you see in Northeast and Southeast and parts of Northwest, and we've allowed it for many years. And it's part of the character of what we think some of our most desirable and most expensive neighborhoods are. Duplexes that fit into the neighborhood in the same scale of a single family house. You know, even in those older, in those interior, the Southeast and Northeast inner neighborhoods, they used to allow garden apartments, but that's not the distance we're going here. As the city evolves in the future, these are types of structures that will fit into our single family neighborhoods. The move to reduce the size of houses is going to make sure that the structures that get built with demolition, to the extent that demolition happens, are more in scale and don't change inherently or as much as a bigger home could change the nature of the neighborhood. So both in scale and in number of units, we're bringing it back to something that we've seen a lot of that's kind of foundational to our neighborhoods.
I think as we get into this discussion, we'll make sure and bring a lot of data to you. For example, the size of household has changed dramatically from when we used to think about, you know, mom and dad and three kids and grandma moving in later. And as one or two person households are the norm now. And as those people, their families move on, they often want to be able to stay in the neighborhood but cannot unless they live singly in a very large home. And so we're trying to address that issue too. So I think we want to make sure as we bring this forward that we get you lots of data on what really is out there and how many of these units are actually being rented versus for the data that we have. And because I think we're going to hear a lot of stories one way or another that are going to push us one way or another, and I want to be able to at least bring you all the data that we can.
And I'd like you to include, I'm sure you probably will, the school data, because I remember when my kids were in school, Portland Public Schools was going downhill. Everybody was fleeing to the suburbs, and then lo and behold, no, they're not. We have a lot more families. Last night, we had a lot more younger children knocking on my door. As we're allowing more options for one- or two-person families, I think we do also have to remember that there are a lot of families that would have five or more in them.
I think that's one of the slides that Joe was showing. Our existing housing stock has a large percentage, the most of our housing stock, in detached single-family homes. So it provides some of that,
right,
that inventory.
Depending on the level of encouragement that we're giving for them all to be either knocked down and two or three more built, mm-hmm. or all converted into smaller family sizes, that does take away from where people with children mm-hmm. who want to be in the public school system can live.
Right. Just to have one more piece of context, just keep this in mind that the forecast is that we're going to grow by 123,000 households. And whether or not that's the 100% the right number, it's of a scale, right? And the pace of development and what gets development is also driven by what that 123,000 households coming in can afford and need. We're putting most of it in our single family, in our mixed use corridors, because we think that'll work and we think it matches sort of a housing stock that it would be good to add. But that's not everything that's demanded. Our single family houses today, part of what's driving up the cost in those neighborhoods is that they're very desired and there's only so many. And we're not adding to them necessarily. So not adding units of some sort in single-family neighborhoods is not necessarily a path towards keeping them less expensive or even, you know, moderating their cost. And the pace of change, this is how fast this turnover is going to be in the future, is driven by how much we're going to grow, because that's where the new development will come from. And today there's 155,000 single-family lots in the city. So even with these changes, the pace of change one might anticipate in neighborhoods is not as great as I think some of our fears.
So just to toss out a possible perspective, rich people are always going to be able to outbid poorer people. So even if you have a city with nothing but big single-family homes, if you've got rich childless couples coming in and want to live in the city, they might buy a house that's bigger than they actually need because they want to live in the city, and outbid families with less money. If you allow for, I mean, it strikes me as possible that if you allow for more duplexes, triplexes, et cetera, in the desirable neighborhoods, then you might be able to accommodate those wealthier small families with a smaller total amount of space in the city, instead of having them buy unnecessarily large houses and crowding out people with less money and bigger families.
Yes. So moving on. So that was the housing, So that was the housing type. But can you go back to the last slide? So how this works together with what Morgan described, which was the size of house, this accommodating these housing units are within the same envelope that Morgan described, so the same height and size measurement. So that's, you know, key to this proposal, that we figured out the size and then we figure out how many units should be able to be allowed in that size. Again, it's only in select areas, which I'll get to in a second. This graphic.
So if you have an internal ADU, does that count towards your 2,500 square foot maximum?
It does, but not in the basement. So the basement is excluded for that. So this graphic, or one that looks, that's very probably looks familiar to you, is a spectrum of middle housing. What our recommendations are for this project is in the lower portion of the spectrum, primarily ADUs, duplexes, and triplexes. So if we have a discussion about middle housing, we understand that that goes to a much larger spectrum, but we're sticking to the lower end of the spectrum for this project. So basically allowing more units in a smaller form is what the idea is here. So now that we've defined the size and the housing types, these maps begin to define the where are we proposing to allow this. This is recommendation 5, still in the housing choice recommendation. As you recall, during the recent comp plan policy adoption process, you discussed the missing middle, and ultimately adopted a new missing middle policy in the new comp plan. Where that calls for is to, where appropriate, apply zoning that allows this type of housing within quarter mile of designated centers, and that's in the top left of the screen, corridors with frequent service transit, which is in the top right, high-capacity transit stations, which are MAX stations, which is in the bottom left, and within the inner ring around the central city. The inner ring isn't shown here, but I think we all know the inner ring's really close to downtown, in the central city. The bottom right map, and we included it here, shows that it's also included in the new comp plan in the housing chapter, though. The policy behind this map encourages new housing to be located in areas that are walkable, bikeable, and are comprised of complete communities. These areas are defined as having medium to high access to opportunity. In other words, these areas have the characteristics that support prosperous households.
Let me jump in on that one, because I had two reactions when I looked at the housing opportunity overlay zone. And I'm having the housing opportunity language, I'm struggling a little bit, because frankly, when Dan uses the term opportunity at the Housing Bureau, it's in the context of citing deeply affordable housing in neighborhoods with good schools and infrastructure. And so the focus is that poor families and poor individuals shouldn't just be forced to live on the edges of our city or in neighborhoods that are in transition. They should have the choice to live in Hillsdale and other places and send their kids to good schools. So we do pay a little bit more for the dirt, but we get a long-term dividend in terms of all the benefits to the families who live in stronger neighborhoods. So I understand we're using opportunity here in a slightly different way, but when I looked at that map, I had a hard time reconciling the idea that this is in select areas, because it looks like the housing opportunity overlay zone is the entire east side. So that's my first question, to have you disabuse me of that, because it seems to cover the entire east side. And the second thing is, if I'm right that it is sweeping in its application. Are we trying to do with an overlay zone what typically we would do through a zoning change, and how do we balance those two? Because it looks like a zone is being used as a surrogate for a zoning change. So both the sweep and then the approach, I guess I could use some help on both.
Well, so on the sweep, the next slide that Sandra's going to show is sort of what the combination of these different layers produces. Within our discussion, within our advisory group, and sort of out with the community, there's two sort of, as of course, spectrums or two inputs. One is put it everywhere because the decision about which places, it became an equity argument, and also expanding the supply economically as well to put it everywhere. And then there was the other impulse to make it much more constrained. The constraint that we started with was the one that we have in the comp plan, that quarter mile from centers and corridors. So when you just look at the quarter mile from centers and corridors map, if you could go back one. So purposes of this discussion, just think of it as the frequent bus line diagram, the top right. And what we were seeing is that a lot of areas that already have this character and really what we think are opportunities for this character to fit in appropriately, adding these housing types. And we know already are neighborhoods where people will overspend for housing to get access to those opportunities, for instance, schools for their kids. So why would we leave those areas out? And the place where we found the resonance, or the place where we thought it through before, was this housing opportunity sort of thinking. Its purpose is exactly what you described. It was saying when we put up affordable housing, like program housing, we should spend a little more to try to get it in these areas because it really will benefit those households more. But in this case, we're just looking at housing that will fit into neighborhoods that could offer smaller units, that could offer a wider range of households. So we thought it was consistent with our comp plan to open up some of those housing opportunity areas as well.
So Joe, let's use an example that I'm very familiar with, which is the kind of middle housing that's within two blocks of Broadway in Irvington. So you go two blocks on either side of Broadway, you find garden apartments, small multifamily, and other things. And they almost work as transitional housing. You go from commercial streets to the middle housing, and then you hit the historic district. And I know not everybody loves that transition, but having lived in that area, I always thought that was a nice progression. It seemed to work. And you have heavier density, closer to the main artery, closer to the bus stop, closer to the businesses. And then as you head further north and east, it becomes more traditional R5, and then it's got lots of protections with historic districts. So that, to me, is an example of targeted. Middle housing targeted near centers and corridors. This idea that under the rubric of equity, we would open up all the east side is a bigger conversation. And we may not have a chance today to go as deep as we'd like, but I really am going to need to understand the trade-offs on those, because it, again, when I looked at the opportunity map, it looked like most of the east side, and we're not proposing to rezone most of the east side. We're proposing to put an overlay map, which essentially changes the rules pretty substantially. And I want to know what we're trading here, and what our other alternatives are, because I'm old enough now, with my 8 years on this council, to remember when we used to say that the deal was that we would enforce an urban growth boundary, protect our R5 neighborhoods, and put growth in places that could accommodate it. So we said South Waterfront, corridors, other places. We put that density where you could. This seems like, if I'm not mistaken, a pretty substantial departure from that. And I guess as a supporter of middle housing, the question for me is where middle housing goes, not whether. And this looks very broad, and I guess I'd have to understand what the trade-offs are and why you think this approach is better than a more targeted approach.
I think it might help if you My understanding is it's not the entire east side. It's a combination of the frequent service, the centers, and what you call the inner ring. I think it might help to explain what are the boundaries of the inner ring and why is that different?
Is that accurate?
It's those three things.
Well, that's what the comprehensive plan is identified as sort of the centers and corridors. When the comp plan refers to centers and corridors, it's referring to the geography a version of the geography you just described. If you look at the frequent bus map as a surrogate for corridors, even some of the areas that Commissioner Fish just described are not on that map. And so part of what we were struggling with is it's an accident of geography that bus, you know, what we call a corridor are separated because of our street grid, and they're leaving out areas that even today have this character and are full of opportunity. So when we looked at that, that's in part what made it seem reasonable to bring those areas in. The pace of change, I think, is in part what you're talking about, Commissioner Fish, and I'd like to come back to that with information that I think might explain our reasoning more.
Okay, Joe, I want to sort of a geographic clarification. Are we saying that the overlay zone is really the entire east side, or it's still a subset defined by frequent service centers and what we call the inner ring?
And the housing opportunity areas. So it's a subset of the east side. How many lots is it, Morgan?
How many lots?
Yeah.
It's approximately 95,000 out of 150.
Okay, but again, the description is establish housing opportunity overlay zone in select areas within a quarter mile of centers, corridors, the frequent bus service, and high-capacity transit, within the east inner ring neighborhoods, and medium to high opportunity neighborhoods is designated in the new comprehensive plan.
Yeah.
So I guess it goes beyond just the inner ring. Can you remind us what medium to high opportunity neighborhoods were defined as in the comp plan?
Yeah, and then maybe you want to go back to that, if you could just scan back to that map quickly. They are areas with public services, parks, schools, access to commercial, access to transit, and other sort of amenities that support the households and the both in terms of affordability by chance to not be so dependent on the automobile, and the quality of those services because of the economic mix.
And I think the walkability and bikeability of those areas is crucial. So in the policy that refers to the housing opportunity map, it talks about active transportation being a key component to household prosperity. As you know, we've had lots of discussions about not only the cost of housing rising, but the cost of transportation rising too. So the more we can put people in areas that have access to active transportation, the more prosperous those households can be.
Thank you. And I also just want to mention that I know that there are advocates who say, why should you not allow middle housing everywhere? What is the downside of having a duplex or a triplex in a block anywhere in the city? So this actually does not go as far as a number of advocates would have wanted.
Correct.
So just to go back to the numbers, I think the numbers are important. So about two-thirds of the lots in the city would be covered under the notion of select areas. But even that we have to put a footnote, because according to the boundary map, we're taking David Douglas School District out. It's a small amount of lots, it's a fairly large piece of geography. So the net effect is that the east side from the river to 205 is largely is covered under one of these categories or another,
right.
Heavily concentrated there.
Yeah, which is not surprising, because those era, you know, it's a streetcar era neighborhoods, high connectivity, lots of sidewalks, and this kind of matches, you know, the sidewalk map that we've all been looking at too, and the lack of sidewalks, the lack of frequent transit, et cetera. So it's putting people where the services are.
I'm not, in my own thinking, at the point of having a clear decision on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And So I'm going to come back at the next time we come together and ask, how would it be different if it was more targeted, and what are the pluses and minuses? Because that's what you're pitching. And two, what precedents do we have for using so-called opportunity overlays in lieu of zoning changes to make these kinds of changes in the character of neighborhood?
Which, actually, let me remind you, do you remember the A overlay? So the A overlay, which is alternative design density overlay, is very similar to this. It was more robust. It was adopted with Albina Community Plan as a mechanism for providing for more housing opportunity in that area. And it was remapped during the Southeast Community Plan, and we can bring you a map of that, but large parts of outer Southeast are mapped with the A overlay. What that allows is additional density, sometimes a type 3 design review in multi-dwelling zones for a 50% bonus in number of dwelling units. And there were many other provisions that have slowly, the accessory dwelling units started in the A overlay and became so popular there that we expanded it throughout the city. So it was kind of almost like a pilot type of overlay. And an overlay zone is not a zone. It's on the zoning map. So zoning comprises of both the base zone, the overlay zones, and the plan districts. So I don't think a proposal and how it shifted during this conversation is we heard a lot of criticism and concern that we were going to hide allowances in zoning code language and that people wanted to see it on the map. This would absolutely be on the zoning map. It would be R5, whatever letter we have left, frankly.
So would the A overlay go away?
So that's, we didn't want to say that we were going to be rewriting the A overlay, but I think it would behoove us to do that because it's very similar. And the thing with the A overlay is that you get extra density, but you have to go through design review. Proposals, you get extra with meeting design controls, which would be community design standards.
So I think from my perspective, the blanket A overlay in the outer Southeast plan is one of the reasons we've got problems with the Davidoff School District that we didn't. There isn't the infrastructure such as parks and sidewalks in lots of places with it. So given that the new comp plan language says where appropriate, I think we need to be very cognizant of what this is going to do to schools, not only in David Douglas, but in Park Rose and Portland Public Schools. It all has to work together, and frankly, I don't think it did with the A overlay in the outer Southeast.
In the David Douglas, we continued the recognition of that constraint in this proposal. And it'll be a little bit hard to estimate the impact on schools, but that 123,000 households, for instance, that is the additional households, is going to have a certain amount of households with children, and they're going to go to the schools, whatever, even if they're living in centers and corridors that they're in. So it's the distribution of these, I'm not sure, is going to change much from what we have in our comprehensive plan right now.
Let me just make sure I've written down the numbers correctly. You said that the comp plan map as we adopted it without this is 125,000 units.
Right.
123,000. That's the forecast independent of any plan we might do.
And then,
and 80%.
Which means it doesn't change.
I mean, we're not expecting more households because of this proposal. So it's a reallocation.
We're shifting them from apartments and single family into a new housing type.
So you're also proposing some changes to the mixed use zones?
No, we're just saying that this will provide more opportunity. We currently have way more units and opportunity zoned in our multifamily zones than we actually will have demand for.
But and even when you look at it, there's 20% of that growth is what we forecast for the single family, the neighborhoods we call it. Some of that's got a little mixed use in it. That's about 980 units a year for 25 years out of all of that, 40% of the city. So, and the forecast is independent of sort of our land supply once that we have enough to accommodate it. So it's not like having more types of units distributed more broadly is going to increase the expected growth of the city. It affects the distribution of households, possibly. It affects the cost of housing units in some areas because you've increased the supply. You've added this whole layer of smaller units. So part of what's bidding up our single-family house areas is people really want those houses. It doesn't affect that overall growth number in the next 25 years.
So if you could do me a one-pager with all the numbers and what we need to comply with the metro rules and what is optional that we might want to do for other reasons. Thank you.
I mean, isn't it conceivable that this would result in higher growth than we'd otherwise have? Because we're not reducing the number of apartments allowed in the center of corridors. We're simply saying that you could have more growth in the centers and corridors and also more units in the housing overlay zone.
Well, what's going to drive the demand for housing, what our forecast is based on, is really the employment forecast for the region and the city, to a certain extent, the housing supply that we're able to build, and to the extent that we underbuild that, housing prices across the spectrum go up. So part of what we're trying to do now is to address the housing emergency by getting our production of housing in general, be it in centers and corridors, up. It doesn't affect the overall demand for, it's the jobs and other factors that really are driving.
I also just wanted to say that, you know, my motivating force in pushing the idea of expanding the possible eastern middle housing is that I see us becoming a city of apartment buildings and single-family homes, which is beginning to seem like in another 10 years, all the single-family homes will cost $1 million. So it seemed that providing the opportunity for something in between for people who don't have $1 million and people who don't want to live in an apartment seemed like a reasonable thing to do.
Great. I think you guys are hitting a nail on the head. This was definitely discussed a lot, not only with our stakeholder advisory committee, but with the public. This has been the two pieces that have been discussed the most. The scale of houses, in large part through our questionnaires, we got a lot of support for this. It's definitely a pros and cons, like you said, Commissioner Fish. So the last two recommendations under the housing choice proposal are cottage clusters and flexibility for housing, for existing housing. So recommendation 6 is about cottage clusters. Cottage clusters are multiple smaller units on larger lots. They often surround a common green space, but they're typically compatible with single dwelling neighborhoods because they're small in scale and they're detached structures. They're just all on one lot. They're currently allowed through a planned development process, but when you go through a planned development, you're not allowed to put ADUs in it. Associated with the existing houses. So there are a number of units that are foregone during the development of cottage clusters. The proposed rules will allow cottage cluster development to attain the maximum units allowed under the base zone scenario. So all the green houses we showed before, it would basically be a calculation. If you're allowed this, if you go through a subdivision, you would be allowed the same number of units to the cottage cluster. And we're proposing also to reduce the review type from a type 3 review, plan development review, to a type 2X plan development review.
Does the term cottage have a special meaning in our code?
No.
Or is it just a...
But people love them.
Right. Well, it refers to the size of unit. But I don't know that it has a definition in our current code.
So part of the proposal under 6 is to cap the total square footage of the cottage cluster to the same Florida area limit, to the same size limit as houses, with each new cottage being 1,100 square feet maximum.
So I'm thinking of about a block and a half from the Nike on MLK. So coming, if you go east. And then you go to that new development on the corner, that sort of modern development. There's a little package store. And then down the street, there's a coffee bar. Right next to the coffee bar are like 5 cottages, very small. It almost looks like you're at a coastal town or something. And they're very small, well-maintained. I've always wondered how that fit in. So how did that development happen once upon a time?
Well, it's It's from the era, from the era when the rules allowed duplexes and garden apartments, so there was that built-in flexibility. But really, that's I bet it's an R5 right there, and it's just a small house on a single-family lot, and it just was responding to what the developer saw the market to be at the time. They may be smaller lots.
Lots because they are very close to each other, and they've sacrificed. They don't really have a front yard. I don't know what they have in the back.
So those are that's the next topic we're going to get to, Commissioner, is the smaller lots, because back in the day, there was a practice of plotting lots at 25 to 100 or 30 to 100, and you would buy several lots, a couple of lots, if you were going to put a single family house on it. It opened this flexibility in speculative subdivisions. So we have those plotted all over the city. So I think Morgan's going to talk us through that topic next.
So I think, if I remember correctly, that particular development was done as a planned unit development. And I am concerned about the level of review to make it, if we're going to allow more flexibility. The other question that comes to mind is certainly the last time I looked at it, we had a required outdoor space that was big enough basically to have a barbecue or whatever. When I'm looking at this triplex on the corner, where do the families who live in those triplexes have to bounce a ball or do a barbecue?
So we're not proposing any changes to the outdoor area requirement. So there would be that same requirement would still apply for the triplex and for the duplex and for the single house, which is 250 square feet.
Except in the vegetarian overlay zones where you see no barbecues.
Commissioner Fish is talking about some small houses, worker cottages to the north, not new development, something that's like 100 years old. North on 7.
Yeah, I think there's multiple examples.
The new ones are a planned development in a multifamily zone. That's a multifamily zone, too.
Right. So there, I think, multiple examples. But before we leave the cottage cluster example, so I'm being a little facetious that we don't have a definition of the zoning code, and we don't yet. But there are multiple jurisdictions around the country that have adopted cottage cluster regulations, and some of them are actually called cottage cluster, but the idea is smaller units on a big lot with more flexibility in the site design. And that's what our plan development process allows for now. But like I said, currently you would be foregoing number of units because it's based on base zone density alone.
So I have a couple of friends that are getting into the development business that want to in inner northeast acquire some land, put some cottages around a common space, a lawn, and then have a separate structure for communal meals. And it's actually designed for older adults. So you would downsize, have the smaller space, and have a place where you could share meals communally, maybe a common space in the middle. And the more I heard about it, the more I kind of liked the idea. Does this proposal make it easier to accomplish that particular goal, which, as I think about older adults aging in space in a communal setting, might actually have some promise?
Yeah, I think the idea behind this proposal is for it to be compatible with the neighborhood around it, but to allow multiple variations on flexibility for that scenario, for ADUs attached to each of the unit scenario, but within certain parameters. And the parameters we're proposing is the same number of units, but also through a type 2 land use review, because in that case, community members get notice and have an ability to participate and understand what's happening in the neighborhood, because zoning is about predictability both for the developer and for community members. The last thing I want to mention about cottage clusters is that the last portion of the recommendation is to explore additional units when units are affordable and accessible. We have been learning a lot about different accessibility standards and visibility standards, and in this case, we think we should be exploring and seeing how much we can incorporate that into the cottage cluster idea.
So I've met with some folks from the Elders in Action Commission and the Aging in Place, mm-hmm. and I think I appreciate you having that in for this small piece. I think we need to have accessibility standards throughout.
Mm-hmm. So, great. great feedback on that. So finally, the last recommendation, the housing choices, is recommendation number 7, which is about providing flexibility for existing houses. So, you know, of course, we've also been hearing a lot of concern about demolitions and not just the size of new houses, but what can we do to provide incentives for existing houses to be retained and have a competitive edge. So the proposed rules provide some of that flexibility for adaptively reusing and retaining existing houses. The incentives include a modest Florida size bonus. The idea behind that is that if somebody is living in an existing house that already is